The recent death of Woody Durham, the voice of the Tar Heels, reminded us of his great career and his generosity to all of us. So we're re-airing a 2011 conversation with him about his growing up and his broadcast career. Welcome to Talkin'. This is D.G. Martin. Well, we've known Woody Durham as the voice of the Tar Heels, football and basketball teams, and I got to say, we miss him a lot already. And we wonder, what in the world is he doing to fill all the time that he had to spend, not just in the broadcast booth, but in preparing to give us the kind of wonderful insight into the ball games that it was almost we almost preferred to listen to the game than even being there. Woody, that's
well,
the
bless
kind of compliment
your heart. Bless your heart.
I know you don't like
that,
to hear it because you want all of us to be there. But welcome, Woody Durham.
Thank you very much, DG. It's nice to be with you. We had a nice conversation some time ago, and you said then we'd pick up where we left off, and now's the time to do it.
It's time to do that. I look back at the time we talked before, Woody. It was almost exactly a year ago, maybe a little bit before that. We were looking forward to the football season. I was pressing you to say, people are worried that you might retire. When are you going to do it? And you had a very practiced diplomatic answer.
Well, I really didn't have a particular date or time to stop. But the last couple of years, my presentation, DG, and having done this work as well as all your writing that you do, you know what I mean. You have a grasp of what I mean. It just wasn't what I wanted it to be. And it was, I thought that was a good indication. I said at the time of my retirement, years ago when Kay Wood Ledford, the veteran voice of the Kentucky Wildcats, who was a friend of mine, God rest his soul, he's deceased now, but Kay Wood stepped aside at Kentucky 39 years. And not that I was trying to outlast Kay Wood, that wasn't in my plan, but anyway, to go 40 years and I told Kay Wood, I said, Kay Wood, couldn't you have gone another year? It would have been such a nice round number. He looked me right in the eye at the NCAA Final Four, didn't smile, he looked at me and he said, Woody, when it's time, you'll know. Yes, and I didn't really know what he meant then, but the impact later hit me that, I didn't want to be carried kicking and screaming out of the booth. And I've had a few friends that's happened to them. They didn't know when to quit, and they more or less had to be just taken out of the broadcast booth. So I thought it was time.
Well, those words and those cautions were exactly the ones that's exactly what you told me a year ago.
Yeah.
In terms of that you would know when it was. But there are some of us who would there was an old story, you probably heard it. This was, I think I got this right, but it was about a guy who went, this was 50 years ago, 70 years ago. guy got in a little bit of trouble in Gastonia, and he said he needed a lawyer. So he asked somebody, he said, well, who's the best lawyer in Gastonia? And the guy said, well, it's Greg Cherry when he's sober. And he said, okay, well, who's the second best lawyer in Gastonia? He said, Greg Cherry when he's drunk. And so I was thinking, who's the best sports announcer, the best Carolina announcer ever? And after listening to this, it would be Woody Durham when he's at the top of the game. Well, who's the second best? It was Woody Durham when he's not quite as good as he was.
Well.
So everybody, I think, those are your fans, and this is the right thing, would have preferred, even if you didn't feel at the top of your game, you were still mighty good.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that, and I appreciate the people who come up to me and say, well, you'll always be the voice of the Tar Heels.
I was listening last night to the sports show, the ACC sports show that's broadcast on WCHL on Tuesdays at 7, and there's an introductory great sound bites of the dramatic moments in sports. There's Woody Durham and more than half of them,
I think.
So your voice will be there for a long time. When we finished talking last year, we'd gotten about halfway through your career. And so my plan was that when we got together again, we'd just sort of pick up. But I want to change. I want to go backwards now.
Okay.
And I want to go back to the days after when you finally got and made that announcement. How did your life How did things go the days, the hours, and the days after you told the world that you weren't going to?
When I decided I was going to retire?
Yeah.
I made the decision at Christmas time. I got my two boys. We were in Atlanta visiting my grandchildren as well as, and we had both boys there and my daughter-in-law. And I got the two boys, and we went for a ride around lunchtime on Christmas Eve. And Wes and Taylor were with me. And I asked them at that time, I said, what would you think if I told you that I think it's time for me to retire? And they reacted a little bit to that because I think they could sense it, too, the way that I was maybe talking about it. And Wes finally said to me, he said, Dad, if you do it, it's great. And I said, really? He said, yeah, because you're going out on your terms. You know, they're not taking you out, you know, and you didn't get to a point where you had to go out. And so I thought that kind of sealed the deal. Then I knew, and so.
Well, did you feel like he was saying, Dad, I can see closer than I would like the time when the forces might have to pull you out? Because if he saw that, he would be a very small minority.
Both of us. As he grew up in the business, I made him aware of a couple of the guys.
And he'd heard these stories.
I won't call
that you
any
told.
Names no, or tell what already, schools they
no,
were.
No, but you've already told us about the positive side of Woody. You'll know.
Yeah.
You'll know.
Yeah. And but you know, some of the guys just they stayed too long, and I didn't want to do that. I really didn't. And I must say, then the big thing then was keeping it under wraps until I was ready to tell everybody. And fortunately, we were able. Pretty much to do that.
Well, you got
to
tell some people.
Because I went around, I called the chancellor, and he called me back. He was going over to Raleigh, and his wife and my wife are very good friends. And so Patty got him on the phone, and he called me. And I told him, I said, Holden, I want to tell you that I'm going to retire.
Like before basketball season was over.
Season was over. It was within a week prior to my announcement.
I got you. So early notice to people
and
who
so
were
then
close
I went to
you.
The next person I went to see was Dick Bedour, the athletic director, of course. And then I visited individually with Butch Davis and Roy because I wanted them to know before there was any announcement. I didn't want either of them to have to come into a news conference in here for the first time. So We had very nice, and they were very nice in what they said to me about the job that I'd done and working with them and everything like that. And so then when, you know, and it got out 6 o'clock in the evening before the announcement the next day. I think it was released that there was going to be a news conference and so forth. And
so everybody speculated.
The media
what else
basically
would
had
be
picked
saying?
Up on it. Yeah, what else would I
now,
be
what about your dealing
about?
With your employers?
Talked to Gary Soba, who's the general manager of Tar Heel Sports Properties, and told him he was among the first. It was.
Well, I was thinking that, you know, there was. I mean, the stock in Learfield's going. I got to go down.
It was a group of,
like
of five
Jobs.
People, the chancellor, Gary, Dick, Butch, and Roy, and I made sure all of them knew before anything publicly came out.
Well, then you had the news conference, so everybody's got an idea about what's going to happen. But nevertheless, it's got to be kind of a dramatic moment for you. What are your feelings as you're walking into?
Well, you know, you always think about. Is this really the time? That keeps coming into your mind. And when you walk in and sit down at the table and there's the microphone, then the lights are on and the cameras are rolling and you realize there are live microphones in front of you. So we're not going to do this and then, you know, 24 hours or a week or 2 weeks later come back and say, listen, you know, I did this, you know, too quick. I didn't really mean it. But that wasn't the case. That wasn't the case. And then it was just a matter. I tell you, as I told you earlier before we started our conversation on the air, you know, I think I probably would have been easier for me to slip into retirement. But because of a physical, a problem had been found that I had to have a surgical procedure in mid-May. And so I really... It took
so this is after your announcement. Yeah, you had a little health problem.
About a month after my announcement, and it took my mind off of it because I was concerned about being healthy. And fortunately, I had good doctors, and the surgery went better than expected, and I made a recovery, and by June 16th, I was cleared and back at it. As a matter of fact, after the biopsy on this so-called transitional cell they found in the upper reaches of my left kidney, they put a stent in because they knew there was going to be surgery. And I went out. It took me about 3 or 4 days to get accustomed to the stent being in my lower midsection. And I went out and played golf. And I put I put a wrap around my waist.
Stent, just, what kind of stent did they put in your?
Well, it was just something that they needed for the surgery. It was not a stent like you put into a heart or something like that. But it was a stent that was going to be
something that was protruding out, or it was
no, it was just placed inside you.
It
just
was placed in your
it was
body.
Just placed
so
inside rolling. Of me when they did the biopsy.
And so you're going out playing golf with that stent in
and
your kidney.
And my urologist, Dr. Niall Buckley at Triangle Urology Associates, and he had been my doctor on the recommendation of my general practitioner, Jim Kurz, for a good while. It wasn't just that I saw him for this. And he was flabbergasted when I came in. And he said, have you been playing golf? And I said, yeah, I've been playing golf, but it hadn't been very good. He said, seriously, you really been playing? And I told him, yeah. So anyway, but it worked out. And then when he cleared me, I waited till he cleared me before I started trying again. And you know what, DG, it was really funny. I went out the next day, and I just hit balls after he had cleared me. This June 17th, because we were having, Mike Haley and I are no longer the co-chairman of the Carolina Kids Classic that for years has been in existence to raise money for the Ronald House, the Children's Hospital, and the Childhood Trust. And it was coming up on June the 23rd, the following Thursday. And I had wanted to be ready, if I could be, to play in that. And so I went out the next day after he cleared me and hit some balls. And, DG, I have never gotten the ball on the club face any better than I did.
Oh, is it?
And I came home, and I was so excited, and I told Gene, golly, Pete, I just can't believe how good I'm hitting the ball. And then it disappeared.
Well, maybe you just need to have some more surgery.
Came back a little bit this past weekend when I was up in Asheville playing at Eddie Biedenbach's charity golf tournament. Eddie does an outstanding job at UNC Asheville, and he was nice. He's called before and invited me to come, but it was always a week before the first football game, and I couldn't go. So this time I did go, and we had a great time. But I'm going to be working on that handicap. I've been 7-4 times in my career, in my life. And now I can't get out of double digits. I'm usually about an 8, 9, or 10 or something like that. But now I'm more 12 and 13. You know what? I may move to the forward tees too, DG, because I turned another page on the calendar at the beginning of August.
Well, let's call. If you do that, we need to have another news conference too. Like we're visiting with Woody Durham and talking about his new status as a retiree. He and I'll be right back.
Our 2011 conversation with Woody Durham, the voice of the Tar Heels, will continue after this short break. We are rebroadcasting our 2011 conversation with Woody Durham, the voice of the Tar Heels.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is DG Martin, and my guest is Woody Durham, and we're just two old retired guys having a cup of coffee and talking about medical problems and retirement and the way things were. Woody, in my case, that would be very boring. In your case, all of us who've admired you and enjoyed your work, we'd love to get inside both of what was going on before retirement and afterwards. I guess the knowing that you're able time-wise to have time on the golf course, and you always made no apologies that golf was an important part of your life, has been for a long time. I mean, friendship, exercise, all of these things.
It was the only hobby I had. My dad, as I grew up, was not a hunter. He wasn't a fisherman or anything. He did play occasional golf, but not much with his as a result of his employment in the textile business and so forth. But I got hooked on it when I was before I came here, but really here when I was a student here, and we'd go out and mess around. And then I got my the TV job at WFMY-TV in Greensboro. I went briefly to Florence for about 6 months, and then the sports job opened up at Channel 2 in Greensboro, and Charlie Harville left there and went over to WGHP, Channel 8 in High Point. And a lot of sports outings, DG, involve golf. And a lot of the coaches and so forth play. And so I knew I didn't have the talent to ever be very good at it, but I wanted to be good enough to be competitive and be able to play.
So they would be ashamed.
That's right. That's right.
And then when did you get starting worrying about your handicap being in double figures, wanting to bring it down to 7, 8, 7, 6, or aspire to have a zero handicap?
Well, I've worried about it the last three or four years, to be honest with you, because my golf is really in the past. It's been a mid-April till early August sort of sport, you know, because I usually don't play. I probably played more last year during the season, like on Sundays and things like that when there weren't games, and basketball especially, and probably did it more than I had done it. But
I loved getting ready to talk to you today, and I don't want this to turn into a funeral or a session just that praises you, but we got to just say that when you did make the announcement, there was widespread recognition of the contribution that you've made. And one of the things that struck me in an article that Ed Hardin wrote about your retirement, I don't know whether you noticed it or not, but this is what zinged me. The thing that jumped out at me was this quote, what Ed said. He said, this is talking about you, his voice is one of the soundtracks of our lives.
Mm.
So when, Woody, for a broadcaster, that's compliment.
It gives me a warm and fuzzy feeling.
what it is, and you think about, you've got such a great memory, and you think about these occasions where something really, I guess you'd say unbelievable happened on the sports, you know, on the basketball court or in football, you know, great catch in football, a wonderful pass, the field goal that shouldn't have made it, and that
last year's Music City Bowl.
Yeah, that you describe it in a
most
way.
Most weird ending to a football game I've ever seen. Really?
Most weird? Really? Why? It was.
It's the end of the game, and fortunately for me in Nashville, I happened to be looking at the clock when T.J. Yates was smart enough, and what a smart and great young man to be around. He and I developed a real good friendship, and I'm pulling so hard for him to make the Houston Texans because he will. He's talented enough, but he's got a brain.
And got a sense of
And he spiked it. He did. He spiked that ball with 1 second left. And then, of course, our field goal unit started out on the field. They never got to the line of scrimmage and so forth before he spiked that ball. And so the penalty was for illegal substitution and not illegal procedure. The difference is illegal substitution is 5 yards and illegal participation is 15 yards. 15 yards might have put Casey Barth out of range. So he comes on the field and does kick the field goal to tie the game and send it into the first of the two overtimes that they had. And then, you know, I mean, Butch Davis and Derek Dickey, the head coach at Tennessee, had already shaken hands on the field. The referee had said on the microphone over radio, television, and throughout the stadium, this game is over. They start off the field, and the guy carrying the headset that they used to get to talk to the communicator and the technical advisor upstairs during the course of the game, the guy was holding a headset on sideline, and he called out to them. It was a Big Ten crew, and the crew upstairs in the booth, the review booth, was also a Big Ten crew. And the technical advisor, and I found out about him later, haven't talked to him, never met the guy, whatever, but I found out later his name was Steve Newman. And Steve Newman called the referee over, and he said, "This game's not over." He said that ball got spiked with 1 second left to play. See, they were going to end the game. And he said, "This game's not over." And so he kept that game alive because
this
of
one guy who's the
Steve
expert.
Newman.
In the...
He was a veteran Big Ten official on the field, and he had gotten to the point where he had,
was he on the field or up in the booth?
No, he was up in the booth, but he had retired from being a referee during the game, and he had been honored several times for being one of the better referees in the Big Ten. And so Yates got the clock stopped, and they were able to kick the field goal after the 5-yard penalty for illegal substitution. And so then that started the double overtime, and it just changed the game completely, and Carolina wound up winning in double overtime. And I'd never seen one end like that. It usually happens that at least once a year in all the years I did it, something would come up more likely than not in a football game, than a basketball game, that I'd never seen before. And sometimes I had to quickly seek help because, you know, either there'd be an official in the booth with the clock or something like that. And I'd rush over during one of the timeouts and say, you know, quickly tell me what just happened on that penalty. And they'd give it to me. I could cite two or three situations, but that'd take too much time. But anyway, weird football game, which came out to Carolina's advantage.
Well, we're visiting with Woody Durham. We're reminiscing. We're two old retired guys talking about
while we can still reminisce.
While we can still remember. And he and I will be right back.
Our 2011 conversation with Woody Durham, the voice of the Tar Heels, will continue after this short break. We are rebroadcasting our 2011 conversation with Woody Durham, the voice of the Tar Heels.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Woody Durham. And Woody, voice of the Tar Heels emeritus. And what I love, and I mean, this is more fun to talk about, is, and I don't know why it is, but looking back at these, at the great moments, you talked about one of the great moments in Carolina athletic life, as you pointed out, just happened a few months ago,
right?
In a bowl game. But I, you know, there's one moment that everybody goes back to. I mean, we think about the national championships in basketball and all
of
this.
You have to set those aside, DG, because of what was at stake and how they came out. Even the ones that were lost, because I've never been as emotionally involved with a team as I was the 1977 team that beat UNLV in Atlanta and then lost to Marquette in the last game that Al McGuire coached, because that team seemed to be destined to win. Got blown out in a game down at Clemson. Remember this. And then won 15 in a row. You just didn't think. I mean, they won so many in a row after that you just didn't think about Carolina losing that game. And remember, that was the season Tommy Lagarde broke his leg. Walter Davis fractured a finger in the ACC tournament. Phil Ford hyperextended his elbow in the game against Notre Dame in the East Regionals at College Park. But yet they found a way to keep winning. And it never dawned on me that they would lose until they lost to Marquette. Mm. And, I mean, it was really I hate to use the word, but it was a gut-wrenching loss. I'll tell you that because of what they had done to get there and the adversity that they'd have overcome. But the four wins, you've kind of, you know, 82, 93, 05, 09, you just sort of set up there apart because. But there are several Carolina games that'll be remembered by fans.
If you had to pick one, what would be the one that's the most, that people, when they're sitting around tables like this, reminiscing?
March 2nd, 1974, Duke, Carolina in Carmichael Auditorium. 8 points down with 17 seconds to play. That's really a fallacy because it was 6 points with 17 seconds to play because Bobby Jones was at the foul line and made both free throws to cut it to six.
Well, it was both 8 and 6.
Yeah. And Bobby was instrumental. He scored on the steal of a Duke inbounds pass and so forth. But that was without the 3-point play. That was, I mean, they came back, forced the game into overtime on Walter.
How did they do it? I mean, you've got that memory. This is the thing.
Well, the players told me after the game, later on, not immediately after the game, but later on, the players who were on that bench, Mitch Kupchak and Bobby Jones and Walter Davis, John Kuster, just to name a few of those guys, they told me later that it was almost as if Coach Smith orchestrated everything that happened in that game. Because, you know, he had a great knack for saving timeouts. There's no telling how many in his career of 36 years that went unused, you know. And so he's got all of his timeouts coming down the stretch there. And he called a timeout, and they'd be on the bench. And Bobby said later, he said, "Now here's what we're going to do. We're going to go such and such a defense. We're going to steal the inbounds play, and then we're going to score off of that. And then we're going to do this, we're going to do that." Duke missed a free throw at the very end, which allowed Carolina to use a timeout. And he set up the inbounds play where Kupchak threw the ball to Davis. Davis may have dribbled twice. I think it was, I'm sure it was once. But then he fires the shot, which at that time looked a lot longer than probably it really was when you go back and look at the tape. But it was very well out. And the moment he released it, you have certain impulses when you've seen enough games like that, that a guy's either come up short on the shot or maybe he's put it up too strong. And when Walter released the shot kind of on the run, I thought to myself, he's put that up too hard. That ball is going to hit the rim and come off, and it'll be a great comeback effort, but it'll be a tough. And about that time, that ball hit the backboard.
And went
in the net. It banked into the net. And, of course, as Bill Guthridge likes to say, Carmichael was about half full because so many of our fans, thinking the Tar Heels were going to lose, they were headed out to their cars and everything, and the building was only about half full, and it seated only 10,000. But Bill Guthridge says there are 100,000 people who today say they were there and they saw it. Of course, a lot of people saw it on television, but 100,000 said they were at Carmichael and saw it.
Well, there are a lot of people who believe they were there because they heard Woody Durham describe it, and
I'll tell you one aftermath to that, because I used that game in a lot of talks at that particular time. I was invited to speak at a lot of high school banquets at the end. So I went up to Roanoke Rapids, and so I'm speaking at their high school athletic banquet, and I used that game as an example of never, what's the old Winston Churchill phrase? Never, never, never give up. So we're talking about it. So afterwards, people are very nice, and they're coming up, and they're shaking my hand, thanking me for coming. And I noticed this one guy standing off to the side, and he waited till basically everybody got through. And he came up and spoke to me. He said, "Well," he said, "I want to ask you a question." I said, "What's that?" He said, "Now, am I right? On the floor for Carolina in that game against Duke was Bobby Jones, Walter Davis, Mitch Kupchak, John Kuster, and I think Ed Stahl." And he said, "I got one question for you." And I said, "What's that?" He said, "How did Carolina get 8 points behind?"
No, that's such a great question. Some people would say in answer to that question, I think I remember about my coach, Lefty Driesdell, even as a young coach, less than 30. When things like that would happen and a team that got so far behind, a great team got behind and then came back and won at the end. And he just said the great teams
find a way
to win. I mean, not every time, but you just see it so often that during the regular part of the game, but when the end of the game comes, they figure out a way to win.
And I've seen Carolina come from 22, 21 points. Saw them against Duke one night. Matter of fact, that was when Raymond Felton missed the back end of a two-shot situation. But he managed to get a hand on the ball, and he tapped it over to Marvin Williams. Marvin banked it off the glass. Carolina had outscored Duke in the last 3:05 of that game, 11-0, to come from 9 down to win it. And, you know, in games like that, they were behind at Clemson a couple of years ago, and they had that phenomenal record now. I think it's like 55 consecutive wins in Chapel Hill. Clemson's never won in Chapel Hill. They won very few in North Carolina against Carolina, be them Greensboro or wherever. But anyway, you get a situation like that. Clemson's something up by 11. With about 4 or 5 minutes to play, and Carolina comes back to win, and the Clemson Sports Information Director comes by me on his way to the locker room right at the game's over, hits me on the shoulder like this, and he says, "We're never going to win here." That's what makes sports the enjoyment and the entertainment that it is for all of us, is watching things like that happen.
We're visiting with Woody Durham. We're talking about, of course, Carolina athletics, basketball, and football, and some of the bright moments. When we come back, we'll ask Woody what he's doing in his retirement.
Our 2011 conversation with Woody Durham, the voice of the Tar Heels, will continue after this short break. We are rebroadcasting our 2011 conversation with Woody Durham, the voice of the Tar Heels.
Welcome back to Who's Talking? This is D.G. Martin. Woody Durham is my guest. We're talking about, the favorite things that we talk about, athletics, and what we do in retirement. Woody, this has got to be this is
just got to be a most, I guess, interesting is the right word, time in your life for the first time that you can remember. Mm-hmm. We're coming up to the first game of the football season, and you're not having to prepare. But, I mean, are you automatically figuring out? What are you thinking about? Are you ready? Would you be ready to talk about this,
DG, this game? It would be impossible for me to go to a game and not be a little bit prepared so I can really enjoy the game. Not just get there and show up and sit there and watch and get excited and everything if Carolina's able to win the games. And, you know, this is like the second time in what? Since 2006, we played three straight home games. And it couldn't have come at a better time, really, for Everett Withers and his staff, because it'll give this coaching staff without Butch Davis and this team without Butch Davis a chance to get its feet on the ground and then be prepared, hopefully, to go to Georgia Tech the following week and whatever. But anyway, no, I'll have to be a little bit prepared. And
where are you going to watch the game?
You know, I really don't know. John Montgomery and his staff at the Educational Foundation said, "Woody, could we move you around? Could we put you in various areas to sit with some of our donors and things like that?"
Oh, what a great idea.
And I said, I didn't make this statement, and I told Gary Soba and the Tar Heel Sports Network this, that I didn't want to be in the booth. Uh-uh. I don't want to sit up behind him. I don't want Jones Angel to think in any way that I'm there looking over his shoulder. I've already told Jones, you know, be yourself. Don't be me. Don't be my son Wes, who has been very, very helpful talking to Jones about
you know
some things to do. And don't be Mick Mixon with the Carolina Panthers. I mean, Jones, just be yourself, and you'll do fine. And you got that guy named Rick Steinbacher sitting right beside of you, and lean on Rick, and he'll carry you through. And all you have to do is just get the names and the numbers right, and the Tar Heels will take care of the rest of it. Because I did 40 years, DG, and Carolina football and basketball combined won 72% of their games. And I'll tell you what, there are not many broadcasters at any school
have the privilege of
that can do both. Now, they may have good football or they may have good basketball, but they don't have that kind of winning percentage with their two teams.
Well, one of the things that's got to have been on your mind, and is the challenge that the football team faces with the change in the coaching situation.
Yeah.
And I know you were close to Coach Davis, and a lot of people were, and it's hard to find anybody being critical of him with his coaching.
Right.
But there's a disruptive feature, both in terms of having the new coaching and then the uncertainty about what's going to be next year.
Well, I thought the chancellor summed it up pretty good in his statement the day after all of this came about, when he said, "Yes, the timing is terrible," and I think that's what got everybody, because you're here getting ready to start preseason practice, and all of a sudden, and whatever the reason, and I'm not sure DG will ever know the specific reason. That it happened, that the support that had been voiced for Butch Davis since, you know, June a year ago when all of this broke out, or July a year ago, that caused that to so dramatically erode in such a short amount of time. But something happened, whether or not it was what was hanging, continuing to hang over the program, or when you felt like you were coming out from under it, another episode would be in the media. Of this or that or whatever? Or was it the fact that as long as you had this coach, it was always going to be there? You were never going to be able to get out from under it. And we're more than that, as you well know. I mean, we're more than that here at this institution. And whatever the reason, somebody thought there was reason enough to do it. Now, is there a positive side? Yes, there is a positive side. It's a veteran staff. Everybody knows what they're doing. Everett Withers is a smart, and I'm going to call him young football coach who's had background of a lot of schools. He came out of Charlotte, wanted to come to North Carolina, instead went to Appalachian. Can you believe he played for three different head coaches? But you know who one of them was? Mack Brown. He later worked for Mack 3 years as his defensive coach at Texas. He was with the New Orleans Saints and the Tennessee Titans in the National Football League. He knows what he's doing. He's had the best unit on the field for Carolina, the best of the two units, the last 2 years. Really good. Even last year, after losing a guy like a Robert Quinn and a Marvin Austin, still had a decent defense, a defense that was able to win some games for Carolina. So they'll be all right. And the players, they're okay. Still a good defensive unit. The offense, people who haven't seen Bren Renner, get ready. He's going to be a good one.
Well,
I mean, he really is. And the offensive line may be the best under Sam Pittman that it's been in any time since this staff has been here. So if this team can get its feet on the ground, they'll give us plenty to be excited about. And it's not like this is a sudden change for this team, because this team went through a lot, maybe a lot more problems maybe last year than even it confronts already this year.
What do they do? I mean, based on what you've seen before, how do you recruit at a time like this during the fall when your coaching situation is good for the, you know, arguably really good? Got a good, Coach Davis left a good situation for us for this year, but you're going out and talking to a recruit. And he says, well, who's going to be coaching next year? And you say, well, it'll be a great coach, and you don't know whether the same
We're gonna know by the midpoint of this season, because after those three straight home games, then they go to Georgia Tech, and then they go to East Carolina. And so there'll be a pretty good indication midway through the season as to the job that Everett Withers and this staff is doing. And so we will know then, and I think that's what will have an effect on recruiting is how things are going. I'll be disappointed if they're not doing well, because I think they're capable of doing well. But we go back to the thing, why do young people make decisions? It just it mystifies me, DG, would be the best way to explain it. Color of uniforms, facilities, no, that shouldn't decide it at all, because the biggest selling point we've got is this university.
Yeah. Well, that's right.
And the chance to get an education. But unfortunately, a lot of guys don't think that way. A lot of guys don't think that way, but this staff has done a good job. They've already gotten some commitments in the midst of all of this happening. Already some for next year. And so I think we'll be all right, but they're going to have to be more W's and L's end of the year.
I think it'll be fun for us to watch, and I think the thing that's great about it is that while it's a difficult situation, it's not unpleasant to watch great people work out of unpleasant, difficult, challenging situations.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of what this life is all about.
Well, and you know, the other big hire, you very seldom have a situation where you're going to be looking for a football coach, but the first thing you got to do is get an athletic director.
Right. Yeah, that's
I would like to think, and there are some people out there who've got Carolina backgrounds, I would like to think that whoever they get, whoever the committee decides on, and the chancellor makes a final decision on recommendation to the trustees, I would like to think they're going to get somebody that's familiar with this place, that knows what Carolina is all about. And
it's always
– I could call a couple of names, but I'm not going to.
We'll do it. Nobody's listening. Yeah. You can do that. We won't tell anybody.
Well, you know, a name that's often been mentioned, and the South Carolina people, you know, they were just so – satisfied because they gave Eric Hyman, their athletic director, a big raise down there. But what they don't know, or they haven't realized yet, is Eric's never said he's going to stay. He was an offensive lineman when I started doing the games in 1971. His right-hand guy is Charles Waddell, another Carolina guy. And I'm talking North Carolina here. It's like somebody said at Eddie Biedenbach's charity tournament up in Asheville this weekend when I was playing. Somebody said, you know, you mentioned Carolina, and in 49 states, that means North Carolina. And so, you know, I think we've got to get somebody that's familiar with it and has got, you know, the passion for this place.
It makes a difference.
I think you need to be successful.
Not to have a transient person.
And Eric has an interesting background, AD at TCU before he came to South Carolina, former AD at VMI. He was a backup AD, I think, to Les Robinson over at NC State when Les was the athletic director over there. Just a top-notch guy that's done really, really good things. He was at TCU, had to hire a football coach, named the offensive coordinator, Gary Peterson, as the interim coach. Gary Peterson got the job as a head coach the following year and has taken them, I think, to something like 8 bowl games in the last 10 years. And so sometimes things like that work out. But he's been through something like that. But whoever it is, their first obligation will be to either name the football coach or go find one.
Well, Woody, if we were really all the way retired, we could keep on talking.
Yeah.
We haven't retired enough not to be servants to the clock, and our clock has run out. Our hour is over. But, man, what fun to talk to you. Thanks for sharing. Thanks for, as one of your admirers said, that your voice is one of the soundtracks of our lives. And
thank you. And the book is coming. I start on it in September.
Oh, come on. All right. Well, will you come back and talk to me about it?
Sure.
Our guest has been Woody Durham. Wish we had more time. Thanks to Woody. Thanks to all y'all for this wonderful hour. D.G. Martin, who's talking? I'll be right back here before you know it.
Thanks for listening to our 2011 conversation with Woody Durham, the voice of the Tar Heels. This program is available online at chapelboro.com.